Hi there. My name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. And I hope you're going to like it. I'm going to be in conversation with well-known, interesting figures. Now, when it gets to the end of that conversation, don't rush off, because we have got the illustrious, wondrous psychologist Karen Cowan on hand to discuss what's been said and to give us some insight and various tips on what we can do with our mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. Welcome to episode 18 of Shed Talks. Our guest today is an extraordinary person. Someone who's managed in her life to be not only an excellent gamekeeper, but poacher, fox, and all-round guide to the forest. She has practiced as a GP, a doctor, for over 35 years, is the mother of four children, and the wife of one husband. She has many roles, but among one of them, which is very hard to say, she is the National Advisor for the National Collaborating Centre for Mental Health. Or put it another way for us lay people, what she doesn't know about mental health and what she hasn't experienced, you could shake a stick at. She says, "I'm really just an ordinarily strong, ordinarily frail, and ordinarily flawed. So I hope our Shed Talk will help more people feel they are ordinary too, and help lessen, even in a tiny way, the very negative judgments people make about those of us with a personality disorder label." Welcome, Mary Ryan.
Oh, Jeremy, lovely to be here. Thank you for that warm welcome.
Well, that's brilliant. And let's just be honest, this has been a long time coming. I mean, I think we were going to do this nearly 2 years ago.
We were.
And we have... I'm very, very pleased, actually, you know, that we've achieved it. And where are you? Are you in Devon?
I am. I'm in my study, which is on the north face of a barn, looking out over horses and, for a change, blue sky. So I'm in Devon.
Ah,
in not a very glamorous or very smart bit of mid-Devon.
Well, I don't believe that for a minute. I went to Wales on the weekend, and a beautiful house we went to visit, which I think is called Tregaron House. And it's a house that belonged to a very famous Welsh family called the Morgans. And they were very keen on horses. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Morgan, or Lord Morgan, back in the 16th century, was top mates with a chap called Charles II. And that rather engineered their fortune. Anyway, rush forward to the Crimean War, and the Lord Morgan, dealing with the matters in those days, took off, and it was a member of the party that was in charge of the Light Brigade. You know, he was right in the thick of it. And he'd brought his horse from Wales, and he survived, and the horse survived.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
And they
one of very few.
I know. It's sort of so amazing about it. But they came back, and he had 8 more years with the horse. And when the horse died, it was a national funeral. And they he buried the horse underneath his favourite rose garden in the middle of their lawn.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, you know, it's great, actually.
Story.
I thought
it is. Really... It's a great story.
Anyway, here we are, and we're back to you. And what is great about having you on is that because you come from the medical side, and we've never had a medical side person on, but what is doubly great is that you're not going to be speaking primarily, you know, as a medical person. You're speaking as you, which is what we want.
Exactly.
And I could just be very mean and say that no one really could accuse you of being ordinary. In that way, anyway. And I want to kick off by talking about your childhood and in particular your time at a school in Dorset. And I happen to know a little bit about that, so I speak with some advantage. But your dad was Irish, a Irish doctor.
Absolutely. He was. Shall I say a bit more about that?
Yeah.
So my dad was older than my mum by quite a bit, and they had both met in the aftermath of the Second World War. My mum, troubled by things she'd done and seen in the RAF and in the Blitz particularly. My dad, troubled by what he had done and seen, as the first British doctor to enter Bergen-Belsen. And he spoke at the Nuremberg trials. And in response to that, he was never a doctor again. And my mum and he started and ran a market garden in Wiltshire. And he was a very devout Catholic man. And we lived a sort of traditionally devout Catholic life. But he died when I was four. He died suddenly when I was four, when my one brother older was just a year older than me. My younger brother had severe cerebral palsy and couldn't walk at the time, and my mum was 6 months pregnant when he died. And my mum essentially went to pieces after that. I think she had her own story to tell, and she probably was never mentally very well, but certainly through much of the rest of my life, we had times when she was very troubled and very difficult and very hard. But Catholicism was then, and in a way is still, quite an important part of my life. But my experiences, the ones you talk about at school, in relation to my primary school, one of the things that made my early years difficult, not only my dad dying, but being sent to primary school almost straight after that, which meant that the Catholic priest in our little community was waiting for me almost every day. I walked home from school on my own from four till about eight. So that was is still a sort of haunting experience. And we might come on to ways in which difficult early life experiences affect how children and people see the world.
Yes.
And I'm my mum quite violent too, and another family friend quite violent towards me. So a lot of violence from four on. But I think the thing, when we've spoken about it before, Jeremy, you might have been interested in, is a sense of being somehow a bit of a survivor and an outsider. I think if you have tough life at home, you have to find a way of surviving it. And it seemed to me as a child that being clever was one of the ways that I could perhaps survive. And I did well in my primary school and then moved to a convent school in Dorset, the one you know of. And
we can name them.
They're no longer there, I think. St. Mary's Convent, Shaftesbury, run by the IBVM nuns at the time. And there were a relatively small number of us who travelled to that quite posh girls' school on the bus. And I was one of a small number that did that every day. I was a grace and favour pupil, paid for by the local council because I was from a Catholic family with no other Catholic education available to me, which mattered to my mum because it would have mattered to my dad. And in that school, I did relatively well, but declared my hand as I entered teenagehood. And I don't think in retrospect I was well mentally as a teenager, but as something of a rebel. And I think the story that I told you, and we were talking about it before, was getting 100% or something like that in a Latin exam. And the marks were put up on the classroom wall, and putting my hand up and saying, "Sister Frances, I got more marks than anybody else in the Latin exam. But my name isn't there." And she said, "Oh, Mary, dear, don't you know? You don't really count. You're not one of us. You come on the bus." And so that sense of being an outsider, I think had earlier roots than that, but I have always felt a bit on the outside of something, trying to prove myself. And I did eventually get expelled from that school by doing lots of apparently quite dangerous and rebellious things, asking a local farmhand to drive very fast up the up the long school drive in a motorbike and sidecar and deposit me at the front door and dash off again.
Great.
Where actually he was only a friend. It was just somebody I knew. He was, yeah, he was no person of interest. It was just a rebellious thing to do.
Yeah.
Emptying, you know, unravelling hundreds of loo rolls on the hockey pitch. And then finally being expelled when I was just 16 and doing my science A-levels on my own on the kitchen table at home.
Completely on your own?
Well, with the textbook, I had to go back to the convent to do my practical exams because I couldn't find a way of doing those at home. But I was supervised to make sure I didn't somehow cause damage to the innocent other girls around me. So I was quarantined for the exam, practical exams. But before I got to my A-levels, I had realised that actually getting into either Oxford or Cambridge was a bit of a get-out-of-jail card in a way, because if you did well enough at the entrance exam, you could get quite an encouraging conditional offer to study medicine, which is what I wanted to do. And I did the entrance exam completely on my own, and got an interview at Oxford, I subsequently learnt, because my tutor said she had never read such a damning headmistress's report ever in all her years as an ambition student. And she couldn't believe that any young person of 16 or 17 could be quite that bad. So she was intrigued to meet me, to know just
how
bad I was.
Excellent.
And then I got a conditional offer of 2 E's, and even I, teaching myself at home, could get 2 E's at A level. And then going to Oxford was in many ways a lucky break for me.
Gosh, that's an amazing story. Did you decide on medicine because your father had been a doctor, or that there was something inspirational outside of that?
I think probably a lot to do with the fact that I knew my dad was a physician, and that seemed important. I think I held our local family doctor in quite high regard as one of the few adults around me that I actually could trust and sometimes talk to. I had a particular desire to stand on my own feet financially.
Yeah.
Because my mum was a cleaning lady after my dad had died. He left no money behind him, and she hadn't really got other qualifications that made it possible for her to earn very much money. So we lived absolutely on the poverty line, and I never wanted to do that. So
I wanted a job where I could
earn and stand on my own two feet. And that were I, and really, I suppose, in a sort of feminist sense, not to rely on a male breadwinner. And it seemed that medicine was quite a safe and secure way to earn a living. But it also resonated, I suppose, with a desire to do good in the world, which has lasted all my life, you know, trying to do good in the world. So I think I was quite an idealist as a young doctor, as a medical student. I was an idealist. I placed great importance by honesty and compassion and those sorts of qualities. And I think that probably motivated me more than anything. But it wasn't really completely altruistic, because I wanted to stand on my own 2 feet financially.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. But I mean, we'll come back to Oxford in a second. I mean, it's a great, in several ways, it's a great story. This young girl bashes up the school in the end that's bashed her up, goes out and is the only girl to get a place in Oxford and the only girl to get a place in medicine. Two fingers, you know, it's brilliant. We love that. But what I can't help thinking is that you're collecting certain blows along the way, and I can't sort of ignore what you said about that priest. Well, he didn't say anything, but it was inferred. And I'm wondering whether the Mary of that age was, quite sort of damaged in some way by what had been going on.
I'm absolutely sure that 4-year-old Mary was damaged by those things. And we might come to talk about personality disorder in due course, Jeremy, but it's pretty clear that how you feel, think and behave in adult life, which is what you mean by personality, is very strongly influenced by those early life experiences. And I think I was abused in quite a lot of different ways. And I think probably the thing that made the most difference to me, that, you know, people would be more shocked by what the Catholic priest did and my dad's best friend did, because it's sort of sexual violence against children, which we have a great taboo against. But my mum had very negative feelings towards me and was, you know, subsequently told me she had always hated me, she'd always been jealous of me. And then to be in a house in which you don't have anyone to turn to, and the one person who might parent you is not really capable of that, partly because at the time she was grief-stricken, but also because of all of her children, the one she felt least warmth to was the little girl that her now deceased husband had doted on. So I think the person I am now, and the person who had in a way a sort of San Andreas fault running through them, and I think of myself still as having a fault lines, that somehow close over and sometimes open again, but never completely disappear. I've got better at understanding that fault line or fault lines and how to take the best care I can of myself in relation to them. But I think that's when they started. I don't think I was born intrinsically vulnerable to the sorts of emotional distress I've had through most of my adult life.
I mean, for me, I'm not in any way an expert, but I'm a great believer in, you know, self-esteem and damaged self-esteem that's not allowed to develop, being a huge driver of poor mental health.
I'm sure you're absolutely right. And as we may say during the course of this conversation, for me still, that very little self-belief is a recurrent theme in how I see myself in the world.
Yeah.
And I think children need love and praise to thrive to an extent. And if you don't have much of either, it's quite difficult to develop a sense of worth.
Yeah.
Of being precious to somebody.
Yeah. So basically Oxford was a good situation. Those were pretty groovy times.
They were wonderful because I was absolutely in my element. I'd always been a bit of a boffin, so I had taught myself Greek, and you know, I loved Latin. I was quite a bookworm at the time, so I loved the sort of learning environment, quite apart from the medicine of it. And I genuinely loved it. I don't think I did unremittingly well. I didn't get a first. You asked me that before. I probably should have got a first if I'd tried just a little bit harder, but I didn't get a first, although people expected me to. And I did fail one key exam, and I've never failed anything more or less before or since. So I failed my pharmacology exam, and I still have a bit of a sort of mental block around pharmacology. But that was probably because I was too busy going to lectures on literature or politics or Russian poetry, and being glad to be in a learning sort of a place.
Yes, yeah. And but it's great to be having some money. That must have been good.
I didn't then, of course. You know, when I was a student, that was in the good old days where actually there were things called grants. But as an undergraduate, I didn't have money. And as a, you know, that's 6 years without income, essentially. But I worked as a cook. I love cooking. I worked as a barmaid in the Freemasons Lodge in Oxford. I did work for the Oxford University Press. I did make money, and I had enough from my grant to get by, and none from my mum because she wasn't in that a position to give me any. So I didn't start earning money until I started as a junior doctor, which was also in Oxford, which was an absolute liberation.
And was that, I'm trying to remember the name of the hospital in Oxford.
It was the John Radcliffe, only just, because I did quite a lot of my early training in the old Radcliffe Hospital, which has now changed its identity to become a college. But so I did do my junior work in the newly built and opened John Radcliffe.
Right. And by and large, in the mental health department, it had been pretty well okay, or a few glips?
Well, yes and no, I think. My first mental health admission was when I was a teenager, and when I started Oxford, I started there with sutures in my wrists from a suicide attempt. Gosh. So my first day at university, I still had those stitches in, and I had probably had undiagnosed anorexia because I weighed around 45 kilos at that time.
Goodness.
But so I don't think I was completely unscathed, yeah. And I was very lonely.
Yes.
I think the Oxford thing, I found an awful lot of comfort in ideas and in holding my own with yeah. ideas and in conversations. But all my life, I've not been very good at friends. I don't get close to people easily.
Right.
And I don't have many lasting friendships because I tend to shy clear of those.
Right.
And I suspect there's a sort of hidden mantra that it's better never to love than to love and lose. I think my early life made me wary of that.
Of being
hurt. Of losing someone I loved or being right. rejected by somebody I loved.
Yeah.
And so if anything, I kept my own counsel and would have been described as a loner. Okay. Perfectly sociable, perfectly friendly loner. So I often lived on my own. I tended, latterly at least, live in quite isolated cottages on my own, which is not a typical undergraduate thing to do.
No.
And I did have one summer where I think if I were being medical about it, I would have said I was actually really quite seriously depressed. But it never reached the light of day, no.
Right, okay. Well, I understand all that. So just speeding on, we've done the junior doctor bit and the John Radcliffe. When did you meet your husband?
I met John when I was on a sort of connected twinned job between Oxford and Bath. I worked for the Professor of Medicine in Oxford, and then I moved to do sort of general surgery in Bath. And John had just started his surgical training in Bath at the same time. And I thought, and if he were ever to hear or see this, he would know this because he's heard me say it many times, I thought he was a complete prat. He seemed really rather too full of himself. He was quite dapper, quite stylish, quite shorter than me, smaller than me, much more extrovert than me.
Gosh.
And we actually got to know each other when I was part of a group of us who wrote a pantomime called Cinderenema, in which John played buttons. And I thought, for reasons that are still slightly perplexing, that he was actually spoken for, until he turned up on my doorstep at the end of a rough track in the middle of nowhere and said he happened to be passing, which seemed a little unlikely since no one passed the door. And then I asked him if he was actually engaged, which is what I understood, and he said he wasn't and never had been.
Gosh.
And little by little, here we are 40 years later.
Whoa.
Still together.
Amazing, amazing. So I've got a note here that you went to exciting places like Leeds and Exeter. And
yes, we did. They do sound exciting, don't they?
They do, but actually much more exciting that you went to Australia.
We did. John, we've been to Australia quite a bit, and John did his surgical research in Melbourne. I worked in Melbourne in various medical departments, and I actually had my first proper qualified, you know, as a qualified doctor. I had some experience of caring for dying people in haematology context in Oxford, but I actually worked with terminally ill teenagers in Australia.
Gosh.
Or children and young people, mostly young people. And John did surgical research there, and he was there for longer than me because I came back to convert from medical training to become a GP, because that seemed more likely to fit in with the children that we hoped to have. And he carried on with his research in Melbourne. And then we have been back subsequently together on several occasions. And those friendships are still special ones to us because there's something very, very positive, very inclusive and very generous about Australian colleagues and their approach to talent and nurturing it. So fabulous experiences those.
And were you mainly in Melbourne?
We were only in Melbourne in,
right.
for work terms, and
yeah.
we have been to Australia several times to visit people and to travel, but we didn't work in any other city than Melbourne.
Okay, I've got it. Just as a total aside, Barry Humphreys' memorial service is tomorrow.
Is it?
Yeah.
Wonderful man.
Yes.
And
he is great.
Great person.
And Melbourne was such a big deal for him. I mean, you know, I mean, yes. What, he was great to talk. Hearing him talk about Melbourne, his dad, and all the funny things, yes. You know, just a tremendous guy.
I would think of him. I had a completely blind piano teacher in Moonee Ponds, and I would think of Barry Humphreys every time I drove to Moonee Ponds for my piano lesson, because he was the person who interpreted Australian culture for me at the time.
Oh, great.
A wonderful person.
So basically, it's a terrible thing about these sort of programs, or whatever this is called, a podcast, because I was just about to say, so you had four children, and next? And then,
I did.
Four children is a fantastic, huge thing.
Well, it sort of scuppered an academic medical career, which is what my professor hoped I might have in Oxford. But actually, what I didn't really want, I much more wanted to combine being a good doctor with having children. So I worked pretty well all the way through those, just taking sometimes shockingly short periods of time out of maternity leave and sometimes longer. And I moved from being a GP to being a care of the dying doctor after my second son was born. So yes, I did, but I don't think for anyone that is an easy thing. I think there are lots of compromises that you have to make if you want to be a good doctor and a good mother. And I don't know that I did either of those things well enough, but it wasn't for want of trying.
I imagine there was a pull, wasn't there? I mean, there must have been a side of you that craved, I mean, excuse me for saying that, but craved having a fantastic family, you know, unit.
Definitely. Definitely. And that, I think, will still be, if I look back on my life, the thing I am most proud of. There are things I would wish were different for my children, but they are a talented, interesting, lively group of people. And that's something to be take a lot of pride and joy in. So there was a great desire to have children, and given my own experiences were not of a happy family, to have as close as I could to a happy family. But there is an irony in that, Jeremy, because I don't think, as my San Andreas fault opened from really when my youngest son was one, they had an easy family life, because for some of it they had, you know, not necessarily in their primary school years, but certainly through their secondary school years, a mother who was in and out of psychiatric hospitals a lot of the time, sometimes in secure settings. They were on the at-risk register for a while, because at my lowest, I had a plan to take my whole family out and with me, that we should all die in the same fell swoop. And so they had, for all I wanted, a very happy family. They had quite an unsettled family, but like lots of people where bad things have happened, it does sort of cut to the chase of what really matters, and loving and being close to each other. And they kept me alive, I suppose, really.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, when we were going to do this podcast two years ago, you know, I had it all worked out in my head, you know, how I was going to do it. And what I was going to do was I was going to say that it seems to me that, because, you know, when you were 41, you had a stroke.
I did.
And you had a small baby at the same time, and you lost your speech for a bit. And this compromise, I mean, that's pretty enormous in its own, but in terms of you and work, it sort of slightly compromised your ability to communicate once you got your voice back. And, I mean, the big thing that strikes me is that you had this traumatic time, you know, working in this practice, and I would love you to talk about it, where you had this terribly abusive, awful, violent person to work with.
Yes, I think the thing that's true of violent, abusive and difficult people is that they aren't only that. My mum was the person who those descriptions would fit those descriptions. But actually, some of the time she was most scary, because some of the time she could be really lovely, and she could turn on a pin, and you never quite knew what was likely to happen if you said the wrong thing or did the wrong thing. That was also true of the person that I worked with. But just to explain that, I was a palliative care doctor by that time, and I had this migrainous stroke, which meant that I couldn't speak at all for a bit, and then when I could speak, I couldn't move my words together very quickly.
Yep.
And that still sometimes happens to me, as might happen now, because whenever I think about it, I find talking more difficult.
Yep.
Probably because I've recruited the non-damaged bit of my brain to do that job for me, and sometimes it gets a bit self-conscious. So, like lots of people, I went back to work perhaps before I should or yep. could, when speaking was slow and more difficult, and when dexterity and coordination, which also were affected, were not good either. And that meant that I went from being someone who could hold my corner intellectually and in arguments and case discussions, yes, those sorts yes. of things, managerial decisions, could hold my own. And I couldn't when I went back to work, which meant I think I became somehow bullyable
yeah.
by someone who had the capacity to be a bully. And I'm not sure that that person was ever as enraged by other people as he was on occasion enraged by me. And so I wouldn't want to think that his aggression towards me was something that was displayed more widely. And of course, the nature of early life abuse is when you come across abusive situations in later life, you instantly think it must be your fault, that you have made a good person do bad things. Mm. And I think one of the most difficult things about realizing that actually it's not acceptable for people to shout at you or even to hit you. It is not acceptable for a colleague to do that, however exasperating you might have been. And then to explain it, the loneliness of that situation was one of the things that was the fault line for me. Not perhaps a difficult colleague, but then not being believed at all. And the assumption, therefore, that I must be somehow manipulative or dishonest or making something up. And the not being believed was the worst thing. And I suppose, in a sense, then I would see myself as a whistleblower. I wasn't the only person who had had very difficult conversations. I wasn't the only person to be reduced to tears. But I perhaps was the only person who decided that I would speak out. And then speaking out in the NHS then, as perhaps might be the case now, often if there are situations, sort of accusations are made
yeah.
of a powerful person in this context, I think it's more often a powerful men, accusations made by women, it can become a fight to the death. And if somebody wants to destroy you emotionally and professionally, and the system wants to destroy you professionally, it's easy to be destroyed. And I think I was effectively destroyed.
Really?
After speaking out for that. And then I have realised, as I have looked back on what unfolded after that, that for me, I had put so much of my identity into being a good doctor that when eventually I couldn't work anymore for reasons of depression and isolation and loneliness and worn outness, that if I couldn't be a doctor, I was nobody. And so my last working day as a palliative care doctor was my first serious and significantly life-threatening suicide attempt and period of time as a missing person, unconscious on Dartmoor. So I think my identity and my sense of self was so strongly bound up in being a doctor that I couldn't make sense of how I was to live, which seems an irony given what we've said about children and family. But
no, let me interrupt you and just say that surely for a lot of people, suddenly not having a career that they've been absolutely spent their life doing, it is a massive thing. But the only thing I would ask is, did you not feel that you could talk to anybody about that? I mean, I'm not being trite. I did
try yeah. to talk to people, but mostly I wasn't believed, and it it can become like a game of chess of accusation and counter-accusation. And the name of the game seemed at the time to destroy me reputationally so that no one would believe me. And because in the way I have spoken about before, I have always found it difficult to get close to people. I don't have many friends. I do have one or two very precious, good friends, but I mostly don't build close friendships with people. So actually somebody just sort of socially to talk to, no one would know. And what is the case for me, and I think what is the case for quite a lot of other people who share this as a sort of psychiatric label, is that there is often quite a gap between how we behave and how we actually, how we seem and how we feel inside, that we maintain an appearance of functioning somehow.
Yeah.
And so many people wouldn't know that anything was wrong until it was so spectacularly wrong that people couldn't miss finding out, by which time it's too late. Or it wasn't, in my case, completely too late. But the thing perhaps to say about the family question, and I think it is probably true of other people as it was true of me, I think of it being a bit like a ship at anchor, you know, connected emotionally to the people who matter to you, who you love, your like John, the children, kept me going.
Yeah.
But I do remember when I actually weighed anchor and drifted offshore. So I would look at them and think, who are these people? Do I know these people? Do they matter to me? And that meant I could rationalise that they would be better without me. And so it wasn't, it must sound like such an unloving thing for a mother to think of taking her own life in such circumstance. But nonetheless, I think profound depression and a profound sense of loss does mean you drift away from the people who you perhaps can be close to.
Yes, yes. See, I understand. I understand that. I understand that completely. So really, this was what it seems to me was a fairly massive trigger for what was quite serious mental illness.
I think it was, and I think in some ways I still would perhaps be thought of as someone who has quite serious ongoing mental health problems. But one of the ways before I finished work that I had started coping with distress was through self-harm, and I found very curious ways to harm myself, and it's always difficult to talk about those because what you don't want to do is sow seeds of damaging or difficult things that other people might think of doing.
But, yes, yes.
But just suffice to say that I found I could just about focus if I harmed myself in quite unusual ways that weren't obvious. And if I drank too much, both of which I did, to cope. And that meant that by the time I finished work, I already had a diagnostic label of borderline personality disorder. That was on my GP notes, that was on my official notes, and that was what was on my hospital notes when I was admitted to hospital after dangerous self-harm or suicide attempts,
yes.
of which there were quite a few over the next 5 or 7 years or so.
Can I just ask you, sorry to interrupt, Mary.
Not at all.
But borderline personality is often bandied about. Mm. I mean, lots of people talk about bipolar. They're sort of going, and they don't really know what they're talking about. They don't know what it is. But is there a not necessarily a simple thing, but is there a way of explaining what that is?
Well, I don't know that there is a simple way of explaining it, but I can certainly try and say something about it, perhaps in a minute. Let me just see if I can do that in a coherent way.
Yeah, yeah.
The difficulty about it is that to be technical in an unhelpful way, and it may not be helpful to anyone. It's the whole thing about diagnostic classification in psychiatry is fraught with hazard, and the whole thing about diagnostic classification in relation to personality disorders is more fraught with hazard.
Yes, yes.
Understandably, many people, me included, find somehow being told that our very personality is disordered seems like some judgment about ourselves. And
yes.
We've already said that you're sort of vulnerable to feeling pretty worthless anyway. And so as a diagnostic label, it is difficult, but it's also got bogged down in the diagnostic classifications, the DSM or the International Classification, the ICD-11. And actually, in many ways, although the phrase emotionally unstable personality disorder or borderline personality disorder have gotten into the language, they actually are in some ways being phased out a little as those classifications mature.
Yeah.
So now, although it's shorthand and used a lot, it probably shouldn't be in quite the same way. People are being encouraged to think of personality disorder in relation to the severity of problems people experience and to the sorts of behaviours that go along with their particular struggle, rather than to brand someone as disordered. And in a way, at diagnosis itself, just giving a diagnosis to someone is now seen as less helpful than sitting down two people together, much like we're doing now, and just talking and trying to make sense of how someone feels and thinks and behaves in the context of the life they've lived and the circumstances in which they live. So formulation, which is what that process is called, is probably a much more collaborative process in which the patient and the doctor come to a point of understanding.
I see. Okay, that
in which the phrase personality disorder perhaps wouldn't be terribly helpful. But in the lay image, often the words personality disorder seem almost synonymous with manipulative, not trustworthy, narcissistic, dangerous, psychopath. You know, there are lots of shorthand words that people might use. And actually, that is really, really damaging and unhelpful.
Yeah.
And so one of the reasons I was keen to have this conversation with you is because I think there is a huge amount of work that should happen to help general understanding of the sorts of difficulties that people who might be labelled with personality disorder are facing and coping with. For the most part, people with that label are survivors of something very challenging and very difficult, and will have strengths and skills that have made it possible for them to survive, and it won't have been easy for them.
Okay, hold that, because I think that's we've got to come back to that with a few examples. But when you received that diagnosis or whatever, somebody said, "Oh, by the way, you're borderline personality disorder," did you go, "Oh, God, that's what it is"? Or did it make you feel sort of worse because it was like a sort of huge, you know, metaphorical mashed potato on your head?
It made me feel absolutely terrible.
Right.
It's one of those days that I will always remember. I can remember the doctor in question. I can remember the clothes he was wearing. I can remember the colour of his tie. I can remember all the details of that conversation in which he said, "It might help you, Mary, to know what your diagnosis is."
Yeah.
Not what I think it is, but what it is. You have borderline personality disorder. And given that I was struggling at work at the time, and given that things were precarious on the work front, but I was still just about working, that played into a notion I had of myself as unfit to practice medicine. And it was also practically quite dangerous for me subsequently, because it definitely played into a notion that occupational health physicians had, that someone with a personality disorder could not be a doctor. And one of the very interesting things about being a doctor who speaks about having a personality disorder is that other doctors come up and speak to me about their own problems.
Yes.
Psychiatrists included. And after one conference about suicidality and self-harm, which I had spoken at, a psychiatrist said, "You are the only person I have ever told that I too cope with the difficulties in my life by self-harm. I know that if I sought help, someone would give me that diagnosis, and I know if I had that diagnosis, I would never be able to work as a psychiatrist." So it is probably the most stigmatized of all mental health labels, more, I think, than bipolar disorder, more than depression, more than anxiety, more than obsession, More than lots of things.
But Mary,
and
is
that's
that,
difficult.
Is that because, surely, people don't understand it? I mean, I mean, should it be called something else?
Well, it possibly should. It possibly should. But there are no doubt that people struggle with the elements of what we refer to as personality. You know, it is thoughts, behaviours and feelings that make up our personality. And yeah. Those are the things that people like me struggle with. And there is a school of thought which said it would be much better if it was called something like complex psychological distress or complex emotional challenges.
Yeah.
I think the difficulty is you might change the name, but you might not change the negative stereotyping that goes along with that. And there are lots of roots of that. In the general public, I think there is a sort of stereotype. The media may play a part in that. I think sometimes they do. I've certainly heard throwaway lines on the radio within the last fortnight where personality disorder was used as a joke about somebody to suggest that they were a complete no-hoper of a dishonest sort of a person to be laughed at. One of the sadnesses, I think, is that actually in psychiatrists themselves, there's quite a negative view about people with this particular label. And it may come down to what it means to make somebody better. People with my sort of challenges are very difficult to make better. Almost certainly we don't respond well to medication. Often we don't respond well to even quite long courses of therapy. But for most people, there is often something that does help them turn the corner.
Yeah.
And the thing that helps them often, most likely to help them turn the corner, is being met with kindness, compassion, sensitivity and honesty. And just a simple thing, like someone being willing to listen to their story in the way that you've let me tell mine. It took years and years of psychiatric care before anyone asked about my early life. Years and years and years. In secure inpatient care included.
Really? And
when I did tell the person who asked me, his response was to say, for heaven's sake, Mary, shit happens to everyone, get over it. Mm. And that, if that is from mental health professionals, psychiatrists particularly, then it's not surprising that the notion grows that such people aren't really ill, that they're attention-seeking or manipulative. And so the seeds of stigma and negativity, they don't appear out of the ether. They are probably quite significantly led by the view that mental health professionals have of people with this label. And I think if you change the name, which I agree with you should happen eventually, you might still face the same negative judgments.
Yes. I mean, I guess, again, I'm an amateur, but there is the issue, it seems to me, a commonality of suicidal thoughts, depression, anxiety. So you're covering those bases, and presumably people could go, well, you know, that's just that's severe depression.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I think we should use this opportunity to say these things, because otherwise we're just perpetrating it. We need to say, look, the difference, if you have borderline personality disorder or personality disorder, this is what the difference is compared to what we've just said.
It is difficult, I think. One of the things that's difficult, Jeremy, about any label is that most people have a complex mixture of lots of things.
I am
absolutely sure. I can understand why someone would give me a personality disorder label. I genuinely think that I was grief-stricken for the loss of my job. I think that I had had trauma in early life that had somehow created fault lines, and so you could call that complex trauma. I definitely was depressed. But the perhaps unusual thing, the thing that distinguishes people with who merit this as a diagnosis, is that self-harm and suicidality aren't inevitable bedfellows. They don't often go side by side. There are some people for whom suicidality in the context of severe depression is not something that would merit a personality disorder diagnosis, if you believe such a thing was legitimate. And so there are differences, and there are times when how people respond and behave and think about themselves and interact with others are related to things of personality, thoughts, feelings and behaviours, including self-worth. And it may be a red herring in this conversation, but I think my own sense of suicide attempts, and I have many of them, have had many of them, is that I don't know that I ever really wanted to die as much as to want a particular sort of tormented suffering in which feeling worthless was very much a part of it. I wanted something to stop rather than to be forever dead.
So that wasn't connected to punishment?
Self-harm was connected, and I did punish myself. You know, if we were to talk about the sorts of things I did to myself, they would be tantamount to torture. That's exactly what I did to myself,
right,
over long periods of time in really odd ways. But I don't know. It's almost a philosophical question to know where loathing yourself and punishing yourself sit in this mixture of things. But I can understand why somebody in a medical position might say, this is not just depression. This is not just severe depression. This has its origins in something different, in a way of responding to distress that has features of personality disorder to it.
Right. So the distress side is pretty important.
Yes.
As you said earlier, that other people with this condition often had sort of come back from, you know, reacted or come back or whatever from great situations of trauma and everything.
Almost everybody with a personality disorder label will have stories of early life trauma, and they may have stories of generations of early life trauma. There are some people who would say that they don't, and important, I think, for the purposes of this conversation, to say some people, when you ask me what I felt like when I was given this diagnosis myself,
yes,
it felt like a catastrophic experience. But there are some people who are genuinely relieved and are glad to have something that seems to help them make sense of themselves.
Yeah, yes, 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 yes.
And so I think, just to come back to this question of diagnosis, it almost matters more how some sense of a diagnosis is shared with someone than what it is. I think there wasn't enough in the way of compassionate explanation when I was given my own label for me to be able to make sense of it. And I can conceive of situations in which, compassionately done, that could actually be positive. And it does, in some circumstances, help people find the right sort of therapy for them,
yep,
the right benefits, the right work opportunities. There are things that it can help people do. But I think, in the round, the label personality disorder is probably, in most people's experience, much more harmful than helpful.
Okay.
But if it gets you in to the right sort of service for you, that service probably will never use the words personality disorder again.
See.
They'll just take you where you're at.
Okay, this is really interesting stuff. What I need to know, and it's very cheeky of me to ask, but I know that you had... You were pretty ill and had several hospital admissions, several serious suicide attempts over the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Seven, probably.
Okay.
My wilderness years, my worst wilderness years, were about seven.
Right.
I've had suicide attempts much more recently than that, but
right,
my times in and out of hospital were over a 7-year period.
Okay, and was that the same, you know, are we saying it's the same condition?
I think it, you know, I don't know so much about the same condition, but it was an unresolved grief at not being a doctor, a strong sense of being useless, and struggling to cope with sometimes searingly painful emotions and distress. So yes, in a sense it was. And I think people were at a loss to know how best to help me. And as I don't suppose keeping me in hospital for long periods of time was really in and of itself helpful. And I've sometimes described inpatient psychiatric care like being in a rabbit hutch. You know, you're a pet that someone is taking care of. You're fed and watered and watched, but you're not necessarily encouraged to thrive. So I think the very things that meant that the system was at a loss to know how to help me, despite all sorts of drugs, huge numbers of different drugs, two courses of ECT without my consent because I wouldn't give it. All sorts of complicated regimes of care, forms of therapy that didn't help. The thing that helped most and has helped and means I'm talking to you now is probably very thoughtful private psychotherapy, which I've had with the same therapist for about, I don't know, 12 years now.
Great.
Therapy that continued in hospital, a therapist who would phone me in psychiatric intensive care wards, somebody who's committed to me and somebody who I know and trust and value, who once said to me after a series of really dangerous near-death suicide attempts, knew me well enough to say, Mary, enough's enough. You can't go on like this.
Yes.
You'll be dead. I can't help you if you don't try and move towards me to help yourself. And that, for me, was quite a shock at the time, but it was also a turning point.
What was needed. Yeah.
What was needed.
Yeah. Can I just say one thing? This is just a thought that's crossed my mind, and see what you say. Because you talk about grief. Grief, I can't be a doctor anymore, etc. You know, when you were a little girl, you were in a world where you were powerless, you know, where everyone else was adults, and adults were doing things to you, bad things to you. And then you had the school, and the nuns were doing bad things to you, etc., etc. And I just wonder whether there's a parallel, you know, between that little girl and the girl growing up, little teenager, and feeling all this, you know, awful stuff happen, and not being able to do anything about it. And when finally your life changes and you become a very successful doctor and you are able to do millions of things about everything, and then suddenly that's taken away. It's I don't know, whether, maybe it's a complete load of nonsense I'm saying, but I'm sort of thinking back to that childhood, that there was a carry-on, carry-forward, big carry-forward.
There's definitely been a big carry-forward, and I think you're right to talk about power, because you can feel very stripped of any power, and you can feel stripped of any meaning or purpose or value, and therefore perhaps the power you are left with is the power to be self-destructive. And yet that one of the things that is very difficult to talk about here is how often people who are wearing the patient hat feel powerless in the psychiatric system, but also too, especially now, quite a lot of people who are part of the system themselves feel powerless to make a difference. So there is an awful lot of people who are feeling powerless. And if the power or even possibly the magic rests somewhere, it is in two people coming together in ordinary humanity to do something together. And yet feeling powerless as a child, the way I survived that was by somehow putting my emotional self in a box.
Yes.
To not think about what was happening or not be upset by what was happening. And I think self-harm in some ways also puts you in a box. I put myself in a different sort of box by the things that I did to myself. And perhaps boxes were familiar to me from childhood. I felt safer in a box. It happened to be a box in which I harmed myself or tortured myself or did bad things to myself. But it was a different box, and I felt used to boxes.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think I know that one thing you were, you know, wanted to happen with this podcast was that it was going to be of some help to other people. And I think that you'll find that what you've said just in the small way about self-harm is big, you know, because a lot of people have no idea. You know, they go, I don't know why they did it, you know, and it's actually when you have somebody who has no rights has no power. Hello? They certainly do in that respect, you know, if they start doing that.
Yes.
And I think that's true of, you know, anorexia, you know, definitely.
Yes. I think it actually, in a practical sense, I don't know that I can do justice. Other people could probably do explain this much better. But there is something about self-harm being a way to relieve distress. And I think it's true of me, and I believe it's true of most people for whom this is part of the way in which they cope with things, is that mostly we do the least bad, worst thing to ourselves. And I would try so hard to do something that was short of killing myself, close to killing myself, but short of killing myself, as the least worst thing to do.
Yep.
To relieve distress. So I think there is something in how it is a sort of catharsis that comes.
Yeah.
And you would think, ah, it'll be all right, I can cope again.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is probably a mystery to people who don't know the difference that that can make. But it is a survival mechanism, as well as being a risk to not surviving.
Yeah. But you, the great news, thank goodness, you have survived and are still surviving and are also treading quite an interesting path with the Royal College of Psychiatry, with other things. Because it's a big deal to have a background as a doctor and to take the risks, you know. I mean, I don't hear too many people who are doctors talking about being alcoholics when there are a lot.
There are sadly a lot.
Yes.
I think it is still difficult for me. I still find it very difficult not to be working properly as a doctor. But I know I won't be able to do that again, and I'm too old now probably to do that again with any sort of usefulness. I think I had an interesting turning point where I had been on the same ward for a long time, not really speaking very much because I turned in on myself and found it difficult to talk to people. Being asked to go to a ward meeting to talk about the quality of the food by a very nice support worker, Nothing, who worked on the ward. And I said, Ed, I'm not going, I've got nothing to say. And he said, no, Mary, I'd like you to come. I think you could be useful.
We need you.
And that was the first time somebody had asked me to do something
for
quite a long time. And so I went to a meeting to talk about the quality of the food, which was actually terrible. And little by little, I have committed myself since then for the last decade or so to trying to improve mental health care services for myself to an extent, but much more importantly for other people. And one of the things my time in inpatient wards told me is that there is a tragedy of people put onto the scrap heap of life who somehow are seen as worthless, of no account. Society throws them away. And I believe that using the skills, insights and talents of people who have mental health problems is the only way we'll get better at approaching good ways to support people who have mental health problems. Using those same skills and insights, either directly as peer supporters in the jargon, or in the way that I do to try and influence care, policy, strategy, understanding. Because it is living experience of those mental health struggles that has got the most authenticity if we are genuinely to try and make them better for everyone.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. And I'm going to go back to your childhood. And this isn't because of you, directed at you. But if Mary, aged 10, 11, 12, wasn't very bright and couldn't do Latin and Greek and all the things that you did. In other words, unconsciously, you'd said, right, well, actually, I know I'm quite bright. I think I can do this. I'm going to do this. And look, I've done it. I've won the Latin competition. Thank you so much. And what was awful was they didn't acknowledge it. But, I mean, I you know, bang that drum that it doesn't matter, actually. You might be really good at mow the lawn. Whatever it is, do something that you're good at, you could be good at.
And
I think this is terribly important for people with mental health when you're in a serious situation. it comes down to the same thing, self-esteem, you know, that blimey, yes. You want me to go and talk to somebody in that kitchen about the food. Oh, wow, me, yeah. God.
And actually, I think finding people's talents and gifts and using them and making them aware of them and appreciated for having them is hugely important. But it is also, in a sense, one of the things is that there is a sort of social justice thing here. I don't take any credit for being quite a clever person. That's just luck, to be honest. I think that there are many people who have, for all sorts of understandable reasons, don't have a way of escape from difficult home circumstances, and who live trapped in poverty, in isolation, in deprivation, in addiction. And that means that I can't think of any context in which someone's mental health struggles don't sit in relation to those sorts of social things. And you're absolutely right that finding ways to value the skills that everybody has in their community, in themselves, in their families, we would be a much better society if we valued people more.
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, we're sort of coming to the end. We've still got the life jackets bit. I think, you know, you've been, you know, really, you know, honest, which is great. This is what we want. And candid and told us a lot. I suppose what I want to know briefly now, before we get into the life jacket stuff, is how it is now. And not that it has to be Hollywood, because it probably isn't.
But,
you know, you've got the family, you've got John, and I know we're going to talk about your swimming pool later, because it's really exciting, like that. Presumably, by and large, you feel better.
But by and large, I am certainly better than I was at my worst. But I think it goes with the territory that I come up against really difficult times of distress. So I have had suicide attempts by overdose in the last matter of weeks. You know, it's not a problem that goes away. I try to think very carefully about better ways to take care of myself, better ways to keep myself from difficult situations. And I will be apparently fine, but devastated by my own standards, I feel I've got something wrong, or if somebody tells me that I've got something wrong. I will find that very, very difficult to cope with. So letting people down is very distressing for me. Not keeping my word is distressing for me. Not telling the truth is distressing for me. So I do have, really, by many people's notions, a lot of time of quite dark, troubled, guddling along in the shit of things.
Yeah.
But for all that, I am much safer than I would have been at my worst. I feel connected to the people I love. I can see many reasons to stay alive, to be with them and for them. And as we will talk about in a minute, perhaps, there are things I do genuinely find joy in and have learned to rely more on.
I can't ask more than that. I mean, that's very interesting, actually. Really interesting. So let's walk through a door now. We're walking through, and it's a room full of life jackets. These are for use to stay afloat, basically. And I know that, you know, normally people always bang on about film and television and things like that. But let's start with a very amusing one, which is The Archers, and listening to The Archers. And you love radio.
I do.
And how long have you been listening to The Archers for?
I think probably since almost my first day in Oxford, where I had a small transistor radio, and my mother hated The Archers with an absolute passion. Hated it, absolutely hated it. And so I have probably listened to it as much as I possibly can ever since I was 18, and I'm 67 now, so that's a long time of listening to The Archers. And I find it consoling, interesting, reliable, sometimes funny, sometimes sad, sometimes very relevant in mental health terms.
Yes.
But it is a sort of constancy, and it might be a little bit like Lark Rise to Candleford, a sort of nostalgic, lost England in which there were people like the Grundys and there were farming families.
Social order.
And community built around a pub. Yeah. I do think there is something whimsical about it, but I still listen to it whenever I can. And if I'm away for work, I will either listen to it, if I can, in a hotel room somewhere, or I'll listen to it on catch up.
Yeah.
And I do that still. I have to say that I've listened to the radio much less, like perhaps many of us at the moment, when the news itself is so devastatingly difficult to listen to, that I used to be quite somebody who listened a lot more to the radio in general. And now I'm more selective, both about the radio as background noise. So I'm more likely to listen to Classic FM because I'll get less news that way, or Radio 3 because I'll get less news that way. And there will be one or two things that radio programmes that I will tune in for, like Add to Playlist, for example, which I particularly love.
Oh, yes, yes. Sorry, just going back to The Archers very quickly. Two favourite characters.
I don't know that I could answer that properly, exactly.
Two least favourite.
No, because I'm always as good as the most current storyline. I think Helen Archer, as a storyline of recurrent eating disorder and of domestic violence and abuse and the effects of that, has been a fabulous, fantastically helpful story. I think the Grundy family are probably, you know, the generations of the Grundy family that I've seen and come and go are emblematic of the sorts of things we were talking about earlier. You know, people who are really struggling, always on their uppers, somehow finding a way to make their way forward, and that in a sense each other and loving each other and loyalty to each other, for all they've had their ups and downs, is actually what seems to keep that family going. So I think they appeal to me. I don't like Brian very much. He's always seemed to me a bit of a shit, and he hasn't quite had his comeuppance, but he's a useful foil in the story, and
absolutely.
His descriptions of grief since Jennifer died, I think, have been quite helpful to other grieving people.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the really important thing you said about the whole thing is that you like that, you know, it's the constancy, you know, goodness me, I can tune in. Ah, I'm in this land. Ah. Yeah. You know, I could put my battery on charge on this. And
exactly.
For those who don't know, The Archers is a very long running, the most longest running soap opera on radio in the world, about a farming community. If you don't know about it in America, Australia, wherever you're listening, tune in. you know, it's
and blame me.
Yeah, and blame Mary straight away. Yes. And I know that, you know, way above your children, the dogs are the most important thing.
Well, they are. I think they are hugely important because they're different. I don't know. I learned so much from dogs and animals in general, but dogs in particular, about love and loyalty and being there-ness. I could tell my dogs anything and they would listen. They would know if I was in a very low place. They would come and rest their heads on my knee. They give more love than they receive, which isn't true of people often. And they're very good listeners. I love the way they genuinely listen and ask nothing much in return. My current dog, I think he's wise beyond words, but I do know he can count because he ignores the first Archer's tune when it comes on the radio in the kitchen. And he gets very excited by the second because he has supper when the Archers is finished. So he knows exactly the difference between one and two tunes.
Brilliant. That's really good. That's really good. Are you the dog's favourite?
No, I'm sure I'm not. I'm sure I'm not. I think I'm actually boring. I think my sons are the dog's favourite because they are much more likely to go on interesting walks, to take them camping, take either of them camping on Dartmoor or to go for long expeditions into the countryside. My approach is, are we doing this boring walk again? Is what his face sometimes says. So I don't think I am his favourite person, but I am the person who quite often feeds him, and I am the person who says hello to him every morning and tells him I love him.
Oh, well, that's great. So it's now one dog, not the two?
One dog, just one at the moment. Flint is just the one.
A man like Flint, okay.
Yes.
And now I have to say that my eyes widened when I read this, that you'd said that you are an absolute swimming nut and you love swimming. And I'm going to be very cheeky and reveal to the audience of Shed Talks that you like swimming naked and as in very cold water. Do you?
Well, I love doing that. I do absolutely love doing that. I've done that almost all my life. When I was younger, I could jump through ice and come up and swim on for quite some time and survive it. I couldn't do that now. But I swim all the year round, which means that in the UK, I will sometimes swim in temperatures as low. The coldest I've ever swum is Scarpa Flow, which was about 3 in Orkney. But here around about 10, and sometimes a bit colder than that in rivers and the sea in the depths of winter. But I much prefer not to wear anything.
Right.
I will reluctantly wear something to swim in if I have to. But for the most part, now I'm older, I think botheration, no one's going to really notice. So I take my clothes off and I run in. And if people are upset by that, that's too bad.
Exactly.
But I do, I don't know if it's a very elegant look, but I do wear, the only thing I wear is an orange neoprene triathlon hat. Because if your head is warm, you can cope with almost anything.
Yes, and yes. Well, I thought you were going to say a pair of shoes.
But, No. But my feet sometimes do get quite cold. I think it's well recognised that is good for people, and wild swimming is something that's much more popular than once it was, although I've done it all my life. But for me, it is just the most extraordinary way of pressing a reset button.
Right.
It is as if whatever worry or static or fuss I have in my head gets wiped clean. And just sometimes for the duration of the quarter of an hour or so I'm swimming every day, I don't think or worry very much. And as it gets colder, it was about 10 now, as it gets colder, you have only to concentrate on inviting ever so nicely your arms and legs to keep moving and your heart to keep beating. You haven't got much energy for anything else.
No.
You just have to concentrate on staying alive. And that seems quite a good antidote to stress and worry.
I think that's...
Or depression.
I think that's really good. And going back to sort of manual stuff... You enjoy cooking and baking.
I do love cooking, and cleaning actually. I love cleaning, and ironing, those sorts of things.
Yes.
You know, relatively meditative, mindful things, and I will often cook ridiculous amounts of things, cakes and pies and elaborate, complicated, old-fashioned sorts of things. So Christmas is a lovely time for me to cook, and I do enjoy the cooking of it, probably more than anything. But I can also lose myself in hedge laying, for example, where I can get so absorbed with working closely with a stretch of hedgerow that I lose myself and I don't know where the hedge ends and I begin, because all I'm thinking about is the next cut and the next bend and the next... prune. So I do love physical things.
Well, I will cut this, but I'd forgotten to ask you that my grandfather was quite a big gardener. He was the Daily Telegraph gardening correspondent and things like that. He wrote millions of books. He's called H. H. Thomas.
H. H. Thomas, indeed. Yeah. I've heard of H. H. Thomas.
Well, you might do. And
I have.
Oh, good. Well, he wrote a book called he wrote millions of books, but one of the books he wrote was called Making Love to Mother Earth. Very raunchy title.
Good book.
And everybody who comes on Shed Talks, I ask, would they read, you know, 2, 3, 4 pages of this book? I hope we can ask you that. And we're gradually compiling it all together. It'll take a while, but it's just fun, you know.
I would love to do that. I love the title because I think that the more we connect with Mother Earth, the in a sense, the healthier we are.
Yeah.
And the humbler we are. We are just a small part of a very vibrant planet.
Yeah.
And I learn a lot from my trees and my hedge and my garden generally. So I would love to make love to Mother Earth. So I will read that for you.
Oh, that's great. Two more bits now.
Okie doke.
I was very I don't know what I was. I was very touched to read that, you know, we're talking about faith and, just the whole idea that you seem to be returning to Catholicism, something you really, really didn't like in your childhood. But that seems to have now, there's a sanctuary.
Yes, it's a difficult thing having something of a faith. I don't think I've ever lost a belief in some sort of divine element to creation, some sort of golden fabric of goodness woven into creation itself and to mankind, which some people might call God. I do now do the sorts of things, go to the services, listen carefully, contribute as part of my local Catholic parish, but not without reservation, because an awful lot of the fabric of straightforward Christianity seems to be quite opinionated, quite judgmental, quite naive in many ways. The idea that God, whatever you think of God, was fast asleep for millions of years and then just popped up in the last 2000 to say hello doesn't make sense to me. The idea that there are a chosen few and that by being in the right club you get a ticket to something you might call heaven doesn't make sense to me. So I would be at odds with lots of people in terms of some of the core beliefs, but nonetheless for me now, following some sort of routine in which thinking about what God means to me and what being a good person means to me and how I can be helped to do that with honesty and authenticity seems a helpful rhythm. But it doesn't mean to say that I don't see all sorts of follies in organized religion and in Christianity, which has a huge amount to answer for. And in Australia recently, we were in the Northern Territory about 6 weeks ago, it is clear the damage that missionary Christianity did to Indigenous communities across the world.
Right.
Devastating damage. And Christianity has yet to, I think, acknowledge the harm that it has done.
Interesting. We'll have to get you back to talk more of that. Now, the final thing, okay, we love the fact that you put down that you like listening to Test Match Special.
I love it. I absolutely love it. That's
cricket,
it.
Everybody.
It is cricket. I love it. I love it in the way I love the Archers. I love it because of the humour in it. I love the wit. I love the anchor. I like it least when the score matters to me. And I like it probably least when it's too exciting. I think Geoffrey Boycott scoring, I've forgotten even who was the commentator at the time, who, John Wilmot, is that right? What was his name?
Yeah.
Would say, and that's just one run, with such a sort of recurring rhythm of consolation.
Oh, who had a Hampshire accent, didn't he?
Yes, Geoffrey Boycott batting, yeah, and the refrain, and that's just one run. And I would then hear that and think, it'll be all right. It's just one run. So a sort of high-pitched frenzy of excitement in which people are thrashing fours and sixes is less my sort of test match special.
Yeah, you don't want
But I can be very excited by that too.
Okay. Mary, this is all sounding very good.
This is all,
very good. Okay, the final thing I'm going to say to you that I say to everybody, and this is quite funny because you are a doctor. There was a doctor in 1873 who, when asked, his name was Dr. McTavish, when asked, what do you need to be happy? He said, you need three things. One, you need something to do. Two, you need someone or something to love. And three, you need something to hope for.
Mm.
Would you agree with that?
Completely. I completely agree with that. Dr. McTavish spoke wisely and well, I think. Although I would perhaps love to have a conversation with him about what hope means. But I agree with him that everybody needs something to hope for.
Brilliant. Well, you just said that he spoke wisely and well, and that's what you've done. Thank you, Mary. Absolutely tip top and tidy. Really, really good. And we'll be coming you back to talk more about cricket and all sorts of other things another time.
It's been lovely talking to you, Jeremy, and I have loved being in your shed with you, even if it's taken us a couple of years to get here.
I know.
Thank you for your sensitivity and kindness and skill. A lovely conversation. Thank you.
Oh, great. Well, I've really enjoyed it. So, you know, that's really, really brilliant.